It's a Coaching Carousel Tuesday on the Pick Six Podcast. Hello, everybody. I'm Sam McEwen along with Jimmy Watkins. Jimmy, how are you?
Sam, I'm well. I'm prepared to drive about 10 hours to Indiana this weekend. And yourself?
I'm pretty good. I'm prepared to do about 10 hours of stories on coaches that Nebraska hires. Evan Bland not with us today. He's out of the recruiting outpost somewhere in Fort Kearney, maybe out in Fort Robinson, covering recruiting. He's not actually at Fort Kearney or Fort Robinson.
He's holding down the fort, though.
He's holding down one of the forts somewhere in Nebraska. Evan is doing recruiting stuff and transfer portal stuff, things like that. We're coming to you on a Tuesday before there's been a bunch of news that is broken. So this podcast, we'll talk a little bit about what we think is going to happen here pretty soon, and then we'll have a reaction podcast, I suspect, next Tuesday. So this is sort of the calm before the storm, then the storm's going to hit, and then we're going to talk about the calm after the storm. Probably next week.
So it's good timing, honestly.
It is.
Times up pretty well for us, content-wise.
It is. And it times up well for basketball, too. We're going to get into basketball. Nebraska plays NC State on Wednesday night, and then they have a two-game Big Ten stint, and then the Big Ten season starts in earnest, I think late December, early January. But they start their Big Ten play this weekend at Indiana, and then versus
Michigan.
The Blue Blood, Michigan.
Michigan.
And if Tom Michigan, you'll see this, Jimmy, when they come in. Michigan's program is the Cadillac of
They're buttoned up.
They're Cadillac. Michigan State is sort of the like the blue collar tough guy thing. But when Michigan comes in, it's top of the line. It's Jordan brand. It's a million, walk ons and all these other things. It's the Cadillac of the Big Ten. Indiana's kind of like that too. Certainly, seeing those uniforms up close is a pretty cool thing, and you'll be able to do that this weekend. We're going to start with Nebraska football. The Husker football season ended on Friday. Not going to belabor that. Nebraska lost 28-21 to Iowa. Another special teams gaffe. A block punt where Nebraska basically just didn't block a guy.
A block punt that you kind of called, Sam.
Yeah,
in the lead up to the game.
Sure. Yep. I think that I wasn't surprised that there was a mistake and the game turned on that. Nebraska led 21-6, and then the meltdown began. It was 21-9, I think, when the block punt happened. That made it 21-16, and from there, Nebraska didn't have much of a chance. Logan Smothers played okay in that game. Pretty darn good for three quarters. Really bad for one quarter in the fourth quarter. Nebraska's defense wilted down the stretch. They got a little tired. The special teams was the special teams, and the Huskers finished the season 3-9, the worst record since 1957. I wasn't alive in 1957. I have older brothers, and they weren't alive in 1957. There are some people listening to this podcast whose parents weren't alive.
I don't think my mother was alive.
Yeah, it's been a long time. This is the Bill Jennings era, and of course, the coaching stint so far that seems the closest to Scott Frost is Bill Jennings. And Frost will get one more year to try to change the trajectory of that. And one of the things he's going to be doing while he is trying to do that is hiring a slate of new coaches, at least four, in theory. They could have more if one of their defensive coaches leaves. I don't anticipate that being the case at this moment. I believe all the defensive coaches are on the road recruiting. Now, of course, that can change. The coaching carousel just started spinning here in the last however many days with seismic departures from both Oklahoma and Notre Dame to USC and LSU.
It's not a merry-go-round spin. This is a...
That's right.
This is a tornado whirlpool type spin.
That's right.
That thing is moving.
It is moving
fast.
Better
grab a rail if you can.
Side note, USC fired Clay Helton early in the season. I think the presumption was, well, they've got to get a start on this. And who are we kidding? Lincoln Riley was not who they thought they were going to get. They did as well as they possibly could in this process, and they ended up getting a guy that, for whatever reason, just wanted to get the hell out of Oklahoma. I think it's probably because the Oklahoma was about to go into a very tough circumstance in the SEC, but Lincoln Riley could have done that next year or two. So what a fortuitous bounce for USC. Good for them. They caught him at the right moment after they lost Oklahoma State, but what a fortuitous bounce for them. I don't know that LSU got a fortuitous bounce with Brian Kelly. We'll get more into this in a minute. I think they're getting a guy who's not necessarily running toward, but maybe running from, got tired of Notre Dame. Maybe Notre Dame got a little tired of him. And Brian Kelly's sort of autocratic style may not play so well at LSU. I guess we'll find out. He's going to have to do a few things that maybe Brian Kelly's just not used to doing now that he's at LSU, like doing what he has to do to get some players who can beat Alabama. Brian Kelly's come nowhere near beating Alabama in his time at Notre Dame, and so good luck to him. We'll get to that in a little bit, but let's get back to Nebraska football for a minute. Scott Frost has been interviewing coaches. This much I know, this much I can kind of relay. Jimmy will ask me a few questions here so it can bounce off to me and it's not just a monologue. Scott Frost has been interviewing coaches. He's been executing a process that I think is more detailed than maybe people would think. I think that as it relates to the offensive coordinator, there's a desire to get it, as what has been told to me, extremely right. I think there's the word measured has been used. Methodical has been used. Now, measured and methodical in this environment doesn't necessarily mean that they are going to hire somebody in 3 months. They're going to hire somebody pretty quickly, but they did not necessarily pull the trigger right out of the box on Monday. There's a lot of names flying around. There is an analytical aspect to this, a sort of data component. They're not ignoring that piece. They're not just going on feels and names and things like that. So I can share just a little bit of kind of where I think things are at. The offensive coordinator thing seems still measured and still in the process. I don't know that that is imminent. And when it is imminent, it's going to happen pretty fast. I think Nebraska's tried to keep that under wraps. Nebraska's not necessarily kept under wraps. It's pursuit of Mickey Joseph, who is the former LSU wide receivers coach. He's been there since 2017. I do think there is a spot for him on the staff if Joseph wants it. I think there was a sense that right as it's Tuesday at about 3:15 right now, that there might have been something by Tuesday at noon, and there wasn't. And Joseph has to at least consider what Brian Kelly may or may not offer him. I don't know. And then there might be some other jobs out there, but I think Nebraska would happily add Mickey Joseph to the operation, maybe as a recruiting coordinator, wide receivers coach. They'd have to pay for it. Joseph was going to make $550,000 in 2022, and I don't anticipate him taking a giant pay cut for dear old NU. For Husker fans that have been around a while, Mickey Joseph was the number one quarterback in the nation, Jimmy, in 1987. He was a Parade All-American. He was the Gatorade Player of the Year in Louisiana. I remember him being the number two recruit in the country, according to one recruiting service. And he picked Nebraska over who? Oklahoma. Those are the final two schools. In the same recruiting cycle, Jimmy, Leotis Flowers, a name that you have no idea who that is, was at Omaha Central. He picked Nebraska over Oklahoma, too. And it was maybe Tom Osborne's highest rated recruiting class ever, even higher than the 90s guys. And Mickey Joseph was a big part of that. Injuries dogged Mickey through his career at Nebraska. He got a gruesome injury at Oklahoma in 1990 when he was pushed into a very tight bench on Oklahoma sidelines, and he got a laceration on his leg that was somewhere around, I think, 50 to 60 stitches. He came back. He won the starting job in 91. He wasn't able to keep it. Keith and McCant took it over after he got a little banged up in a game, so... Joseph has a great history with Nebraska. He has been a coach at a lot of different places. He's worked his way up, and starting in 2017, he was the receivers coach at LSU. He recruited, among other players, Jamar Chase, who is pretty good, pretty good, both at LSU and at the Bengals. I think that's an opportunity there. Special teams, I think two names that have certainly emerged on my radar, Bill Bush, who is an internal candidate, an analyst who has worked for many, many, many different programs. In some capacity at times, he's been a special teams guy. At other times, he's just been a defensive assistant or a defensive coordinator. For people who have followed Nebraska for a long time, Bush was on Bill Callahan's staff 2004 through 2007. Ricky Brumfield is another one. His son is a walk-on at Nebraska, and he is the Virginia special teams coordinator and a good recruiter as well. Knows Louisiana, knows New Orleans. Would be an interesting person to add. His special teams this year weren't great. They were good 2 years ago in 2019. Offensive line coach, let's just see. Let's just see where that goes. I think that would be the best word, best phrase that I would use. I know there's been some names out there. Interesting names. Be curious to see what they do with the offensive coordinator job first and whether that coordinator is a line coach or a quarterback's coach or a running back's coach. Let's see. And then I think coordinator is that last piece. That's the one where you're going to want to watch what they do. If the coordinator is also an O-line coach, then maybe you go running back, wide receiver, tight end, quarterback. I think Scott can probably do the quarterbacks. So there's that. That's kind of where it's at this moment. I think there was some sense that, again, maybe something would be announced today. That hasn't happened. Joseph seems the most likely to join the staff on some capacity, followed by one of those special teams guys. And then after that, I don't know that there's a definitive answer on offensive coordinator. Recruiting is recruiting. They've got a couple official visitors this weekend, and the transfer portal is up and humming. They're following Spencer Rattler. Spencer Rattler on the portal. And
would Spencer Rattler not have better options?
My sense is Spencer Rattler is going to end up in the Pac-12. Okay. He could go both to Arizona, where Jed Fish is at, or Arizona State. He's from Phoenix. I don't think Jaden Daniels is going to come back for Arizona State. I think he's going to go to the NFL. My sense is Washington will be heavy on the radar for Rattler. Kalen DeBoer just took the job up there, and they don't have a quarterback. They don't have a quarterback. And the guy they played this year wasn't any good. He was a freshman. So I can see Rattler going there. I think he'll end up in the Pac-12. But anyway, they're following him. They made a couple of offers. Things are, I think, moving in a preliminary direction. I think we'll know a lot more here in the next 2 to 3 to 4 days. And we'll know a heck of a lot more in a couple of weeks when they have a signing day. So that's kind of where things are at. I think that's kind of what people anticipate or expect at this moment to be true. But nevertheless, I think Nebraska is moving in a certain direction. To me, it's more important how they think about the jobs than the names that emerge for the jobs. It comes back on how Frost imagines that offensive staff working versus what the names are of the people.
Well, let's pick up right there on that last note that you had. You wrote a story about this earlier this week where you kind of outlined, kind of as you just did right now, what you knew with the coaching search. And one of the things that you mentioned, I think this was your third bullet, was finding the right balance between three F's, which I believe were fit, fame, and functionality.
That's
for
right.
For the offensive coordinator. What is the right balance between fit, fame, and functionality for the offensive coordinator, Sam?
Well, I don't think fame matters that much when you're in this kind of situation. I do think when you're trying to go from maybe one level of football, and it's a pretty good level, you're 7 or 8 wins, and you're trying to go to the very highest level, there is a circumstance where maybe you bring a coordinator in who's done it before and maybe a little bit of a hard ass and have an edge to him, but he gets you from 9 to 12. You know what I mean? Like that you can do that. Sometimes you need that. I don't think that's where Nebraska's at. Nebraska's 3-9. They're coming off a 3-9 season with a bunch of one score losses, and the coach is on the flaming hot seat, right? The first time he loses in 2022, and fans better hope that's not in Ireland, but the first time he loses in 2022, there's going to be a question about his job status. So you better, sure as hell, have people in your staff who you feel really comfortable with and can hit the ground running with you as quickly as possible. I think that's just a paramount here. This isn't about bringing in some sort of quirky ideological hire who, you know, wants to reframe everything and take you from 9 to 12. I actually think the hardest leap to make, Jimmy, in this sport is from that 9 to 12 spot. You know, you can go from 9 wins to 12. It's very hard to get up to that 12. That plateau is hard to get up to, and it's hard to stay there. Going from 3 to 7, go with comfort, baby. Get what makes you feel good about it. Get guys who can communicate with your kids. So I think fit is important. Personal fit, what I mean by that is personal fit with the head coach. And then functionality is, you know, does what they want to do work with what your context is? You know, like I could have, as an example, like I'm a sports editor. I could hire a reporter who I like a great deal personally, but fancies doing something that is of very little benefit to me. You know, like, or very little benefit to the operation that we're in. Like, boy, I really like Major League Baseball. Well, that's good. You might want to go to a market where Major League Baseball is something they cover, because college baseball isn't that big of a deal. Even when they're good, it's not as big of a deal around here as football or basketball. Like, it would not behoove me to hire somebody that says, yeah, I really hate football. I don't want to be anywhere around it. Okay, well then, good luck to you. Go find the hockey market. But we need somebody who's a little conversant in that sport.
I got a group of drunk Nebraska fans from the elevator at Iowa, or during the Iowa game, that would disagree with you about that baseball statement. They were already looking forward to baseball season in the elevators on the way down from where was I going? That was, I think it was for the post game press conference. But people were talking about baseball. People were talking about the bowling team.
Nebraska fans are very, very, they love it. But of course, the people who would be at the stadium are passionate. They like all the sports. But, you know, the random person in Sarpy County,
no, I get
or
you.
Washington County or Saunders County, who's, you know, hunting all weekend, they pretty much, you know, football.
It's not on their radar. I got you.
That's just kind of how it goes. So, but what I mean by functionality is maybe they fit with your personality, but they also have to be functional. A person who comes into this job has to understand that it's not the Conference USA, it's the Big Ten. And so can what they want to do fit in the league that they're coming into?
And can they make it fit in 1 year with very little buildup? Mm-hmm. I mean, you got one offseason, one shot at this.
Yep.
I was really interested when we were talking to Scott after the assistant fallout during the season. He was talking about how he was really surprised by the interest he'd gotten, or really pleased by the interest he'd gotten. He, you know, I don't know if he used this word, but it felt like he was trying to say, "Oh man, we're gonna have no problem filling this job." And you know, there's a finite amount of college football coaching jobs out there, so I understand that to a certain extent. But what is the gap between that, what he's telling us, and the reality? How much of the this is a one could potentially be only a 1 year gig? How much does that matter?
I don't think it matters that much, because you can always give somebody a 2 year contract, and you know, most people go into this thing with their eyes wide open. You know, I think it might be a factor as it relates to potentially like a defensive coordinator like Eric Chenander, who wants to go get a different job and has a 3 year, you know, has a 3 year runway and gets a 3 year contract with, I don't know, LSU. I don't think that's going to happen, to be clear. I just want to back up and make sure that fans don't panic about what I just said. But I would think it would matter more with coaches who are already here. If there's a coach out there who's looking for a job, they're looking for a job. So they're looking for a job, whether they were leaving, whether they were, you know, whether they're out of a job because their head coach was fired, they're looking. So you don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth. You know, if Nebraska's willing to pay, if they're willing to pay, you know, high six figures or low seven figures for an offensive coordinator, well, shoot, people will come. For that, they'll come to Nebraska. You know, so I think there's going to be really good options out there. Let me say this. I watching Nebraska's offense the last 2 weeks with Frost kind of running it, against Wisconsin and Iowa, he put those two defenses in the corner and hit some body blows. Seven touchdowns over the course of those games, and neither one of those teams gives up three touchdowns per game. So the scheme and what they want to do and what they envision doing ain't that bad. I think the bigger question is player development. Fundamentals, executing in crucial moments, developing not a rubric but a methodology by which you can get kids to learn an offense so that when they learn it, they can stay on the field and do a bunch of the other things. If physically speaking, Marvin Scott should be a good pass rusher. He's a power lifter. You know what I'm saying? Like, physically speaking, Jaquez Yant should be a pretty good pass blocker. He's huge. But they're not. And that's more about, you know, how you learn and learning it and then being able to replicate what you learn versus the physical capability to do it. That's why Ramir Johnson was playing and some of the other guys who are bigger than Ramir Johnson weren't. And so I think you got to find some people who can develop players, not only physically, but in a way that helps them to learn what they're supposed to learn. And then you've got to find somebody who can at least, who can either give you a template, like a blueprint, or tweak points when it comes to the red zone. Because Nebraska's red zone offense borders on good, and it often teeters back into poor. And it was a little better this year, so I don't want to belabor the point. They had a couple lucky situations with Northwestern where I think they were inside the 20 five times, and they scored every time. So that kind of skews the numbers. But they could be a little bit better in the red zone, and just being a little bit better in the red zone will make them a much better program. And so I think either a blueprint or tweak points where in the course of a game you can say, here's how we exploit this, or here's how we throw a fade pattern so that we can create a scenario where our quarterback and our receivers win more often than they lose on that particular play, and there's confidence in calling it. And Nebraska virtually never called it this season because they don't have confidence in it. So I think those are the two key components.
You're talking about player development. One of the areas where that's probably the most crucial area that needs to be focused on is the offensive line. The pass blocking wasn't where it needed to be. Nebraska's running back room was a rotating cast, but they also they didn't have a ton of help up front this year. That was probably the most maligned position group on the team. I don't think I'm leaving anyone out.
Offensive line.
Or quarterback, but naturally.
Yeah.
Naturally, that's going to be the case.
I think running back was rough, man.
Yeah. Do you think people focused on? I'm talking about outside perception. Do you think people?
No, the outside perception is the offensive line was the biggest problem.
Right. And so you said we're not. You know, that's a wait and see situation with who the offensive line coach is going to be. But what needs to happen with that position group? What does whoever gets that job need to do that Greg Austin didn't do to improve that group?
I think first you've really got to find guys who are tackles. I think they have one in Teddy Prochazka. Do they have a second? Is Bryce Benhart a guard? Is he a tackle?
It'd be quite a large guard if he was.
Yeah, that's true. They've had 6'9" guards before. Finding the right person for those roles, I think, is important. My sense is Prochazka comes back healthy. You can put him at left and Turner Cork can go back to right. Then you've got to find movement in your interior line. I think they have that with Cam Jurgens, finding the right guards. I think there's some of that. And then again, this is the point where I'm not a coach, Jimmy. I don't do that. Sometimes it's hard for me to articulate it. And the challenge is when you talk to the people who are in the fire, you're standing outside the fire, you're looking and talking to people who are in the fire. It's hard for them to describe how the fire feels because they're in it. Nebraska's offensive plays, so many of their offensive plays, especially run plays, look muddy to me. They look muddy. They don't look the way that a Wisconsin run play looks. They look like there's a bunch of different things happening on each play, and there feels like there's average execution, package plays, RPO plays. The advantage of those is that in theory you can make the defense wrong no matter what the defense does. The flip side of the coin is your offense is often executing multiple plays within one package, and it sometimes can make your offensive line look like they don't know what they're doing and guys are missing blocks and things like that. And so I feel like there's a piece there where they've got to maybe check under the hood of the offense and say, all right, what do we need to tweak here in the engine so that when we run the football, even though we might have a pass off of that, it looks like one hell of a run play as opposed to a 1.5 yard run because people miss blocks. And then the other piece, I think, for the offensive line is they need a quarterback that they can know that they can expect to be where he's going to be. I feel like there's generally a way to play the position. Obviously, there's multiple ways, but one of the best ways to play it for an offensive lineman is you stay in the pocket, you stand up in the pocket, and you move up in the pocket when the pressure comes. And sometimes you got to take a sack, but I think a lot of times what happens in Nebraska's offense is those guys get the ball and they kind of move back and back and back, and then maybe out here, maybe to the left, maybe to the right, and it becomes very quickly a scramble drill play. And the minute, and I'm not disparaging this, to be clear. You know, Patrick Mahomes has made incredible hay off of this. Lamar Jackson, for me, you know, watching him on, Lamar Jackson didn't play well at all on Sunday night with the exception of two plays. And they were the two plays that won in the game. And it was totally improv. I mean, it was rolling to his right on one, rolling left, right. He's back 17 yards on another. This is not really the ideal way that you want to win. Lamar Jackson's limitations, as much as I love watching him play, is when you get in the playoffs, you can't do that shit. You can't run around for 17 yards.
It's also not instructive. There's one Lamar Jackson.
Right.
One.
And there's other players that can, you know, Patrick Mahomes can kind of do it. Russell Wilson can do it. You know, but when Baker Mayfield tries to do it, it doesn't go so well. You know, Kyler Murray can do it. Matt Stafford can do it. But the point is that the sport has changed from, in the last 10 years, stay in the effing pocket, move up in the pocket, climb the pocket, manipulate the pocket, manipulate the defense, throw the football. That's the Tom Brady, that's the TB12 method, right? The new wave method is more of the Stafford and the Murray, and the which is off platform, as they call it.
Out of structure, yeah.
Yep, off platform, moving around, you know, throwing the ball, underhanded, doing whatever Mahomes is doing, chucking the ball 70 yards downfield because you have a guy who's a legitimate world-class sprinter running across the field to catch the ball. So many things that you see in offense is a byproduct of Patrick Mahomes has an 80-yard arm and Tyreek Hill runs the 100 in about 10-3. You take those two variables away from a team and all of a sudden it looks pretty pedestrian. But I think people have sort of mimicked and mirrored that. Well, Nebraska's got some of that quality. But how they were playing it up in 2019, well, we got a guy that's kind of like the only guy that makes the throws that Adrian can't make is down there in Kansas City, you know? And, like, I get it, but that makes it hard on an offensive line when you're dropping back 12 or 13 yards. Logan Smothers, it was second and 11 at the 6. And when Logan got hit on that intentional grounding, he was 8 yards in the end zone. That's a long way in the end zone from the 6. I mean, now granted, he caught the ball at about the goal line and he dropped back 8 yards. That's a long way. You're 14 yards from the line of scrimmage when you're getting hit, and none of those guys that you're throwing to are behind the line of scrimmage. So your shortest throw is about 15 yards. And in that particular play, guys were going way downfield and all this other stuff. And so I feel like there's ways in which you can maybe manipulate and change the offense a little bit. But those are hard things for coaches to do. The teams that do it really, really well, that kind of stay in the pocket and manipulate the pocket, are teams that are Nebraska's not like. It's Pittsburgh. It's Michigan. Kay McNamara does a great job of staying in there and staying in. It's Iowa. You know, not everybody wants to play that way. So one of the challenges for Nebraska's offensive line is to always kind of know what's going on behind them. And I don't think they always do. And the option's tricky, too. You know, when a lineman goes out and blocks on the option, he doesn't know where the play's going to break. The quarterback makes a lot of that decision. And so the sport has become harder and harder to navigate because you don't know when you're going to throw a cut block. You don't know when you're going to be called for a chop block. You don't know when you're going to be called for a block in the pack. There's all these different rules. And I think the line has had problems with that. So we'll see.
And you don't know when the opposing team is going to come back and block one of your punts, right? I think that's right. We're circling back to where we started this conversation. Yeah. Special teams coordinator, priority number one. A name that you wrote but did not mention when you were talking about special teams earlier, Sean Snyder,
yeah,
who was at USC and yeah, almost was at Nebraska, was supposed to be an analyst here,
yep,
but USC offered him a full-time role. Mm-hmm. Is that a name that is still in the wings at
all?
I
haven't heard a ton about that name in the last couple of days.
He got a great reputation.
He did. He was definitely on the radar a couple of years ago. Haven't heard a ton about that name. I think the one thing that a Bush gives you or a Brumfield gives you is a recruiter. and you want your special teams coordinator to be an elite recruiter, because A, they have to recruit bodies and types to a team. B, they don't quite have, I mean, you game plan for another team's return units, but it's not the same as putting together an offensive game plan. And so a special teams coordinator should be a pretty darn good recruiter. Like, he should be able to go get two or three guys a year from his area, and that's kind of what Iowa does. LeVar Woods is their special teams coordinator, and he, you know, one of the places he recruits is Omaha, and they've done quite well over there of getting kids from Omaha to come over, whether it was Noah Fant or it was Keegan Johnson. That's part of what LeVar Woods does. So I think you want a recruiter in that role if you can get it. Bush is a notoriously good recruiter. He's a good evaluator of talent. I think there's this old wives' tale that Bill Bush is a great salesman, and that, I'm not saying that he isn't, but actually what he is a really good evaluator of talent, because he was able to see in, for example, Prince Amukamara, things that other people didn't see. And so Bush has always been a really good, one of the reasons that Bill Bush always gets jobs, even though he gets, you know, he's on a staff that's fired, and then he has to go looking for jobs, is because everybody kind of knows he really knows the game, and he really knows personnel. And so I think Bush would be a good fit there. Brumfield would too, you know. So I think you look for a recruiter, and I don't know how much of a recruiter Sean Snyder was. Snyder was on the head coaching track. He wanted to get the job at Kansas State. The AD at the time, well, he's still there, didn't give it to him. They gave it to Klieman instead. And Snyder, I think, spent 1 year with Klieman and then left. And, you know, so he had always wanted to get the job there, and he didn't get the job. So I think Snyder's more of a head coaching type, maybe needs to go to a smaller school and become a head coach versus, you know, a recruiter.
How much does this, all the noise, the craziness we talked about at the top, Les Miles, Lincoln Riley, not Les Miles, Brian Kelly, Lincoln Riley, all these moving pieces that are happening around college football, how much do those dominoes impact the dominoes that Nebraska is sifting through? Not those specifically, but just the ever-changing landscape.
I mean, they can. Certainly the right name can come open, and all of a sudden you have to consider it, and you don't want to go too fast in the process. You want to make sure that if a name pops open all of a sudden, it's a really good name, boy, you want to go after it. One of the challenges is that that name would be on the offensive side of the ball and not the defensive side, and a lot of the head coaches who are prominent in the sport are offensive coaches. And so their offensive coordinator, is not that they're bad, not that Tommy Reese is bad, he's actually quite good for Notre Dame, but he's either going to go with Brian Kelly, or he's going to go get a head coaching job, or he's going to stay at Notre Dame. A lot of times offensive coaches bring their coordinators with them, just like Scott did with Troy Walters. If it were a defensive head coach, it might be a little bit easier, but a lot of those guys have not. A lot of the major jobs are still being taken by offensive head coaches. Washington, Kalen DeBoer, USC, Lincoln Riley, LSU, Brian Kelly. Won't surprise me if Notre Dame goes with an offensive coach. Really won't surprise me if Oklahoma goes with an offensive coach. So that's part of the challenge there, is you're basically going after somebody who's going to be recruited to where the head coach is going. And that's tough. I think that's one of the biggest challenges of... But, you know, something may pop open, and you gotta watch that. For example, I know a name that's come up is Willie Korn at Coastal Carolina. He's the offensive coordinator there. Well, Jamie Chadwell does a lot with that, but Jamie Chadwell might get a job. He's not gonna get Notre Dame. He's not going to get Oklahoma. But let's say somebody takes a job at Oklahoma, like an Iowa State's Matt Campbell, and Iowa State's looking for a coach, and they're like, screw it, let's run that Coastal Carolina offense. And then all of a sudden, Willie Korn might be going with him. So, like, all those little pieces have to come into play. There's some guys out there with names, and those names are going to create more trickle domino effect. Like, I think Notre Dame could easily be a landing spot for either Campbell or Luke Fickell. I don't think Oklahoma for either one, in part because I feel like Oklahoma likes offense, and they want a guy that's offensive-minded. But let's say one of those two guys land there. Well, Cincinnati's open. That's a great call-up spot for a Coastal Carolina coach. Great call-up spot for somebody who, you know, might be working at that next level. They might call up Marcus Freeman, right, the defensive coordinator. You can do that shuffle, but we'll see what happens. I don't think Nebraska can discount a sitting Division II or FCS head coach for that role. It's a game planning job. So it's not the same as, it certainly can be a badass, but it doesn't have to be a badass. It can be a guy who calls a good football game and organizes an offense really well and makes $700,000 or $800,000. But at the end of the day, the guy is kind of a, you know, a technocrat. He's a guy that kind of develops players and looks at game plans. Oftentimes, you need to have another assistant on your roster who's the badass. Somebody who makes a lot of money and is a good recruiter, and when that guy walks in a room, everybody kind of knows it. And that may or may not be your coordinator. In recent years, it has been the coordinator, but it doesn't have to be. Ohio State's defensive coordinator doesn't make anybody's head turn. And most people don't even know who their offensive coordinator is. So on that staff, the guy that does that is Larry Johnson. On Iowa's staff, the guy who walks in the room is LeVar Woods. Make sense? So Nebraska can do it a couple of different ways. The guy that probably turns a lot of heads when he walks in the room on Nebraska's staff is Travis Fisher and Sean Becton. And they might be well advised to get Mickey Joseph, because I think Mickey Joseph, when he walks in a certain room, he's Mickey friggin' Joseph. I coach Justin Jefferson and Jamar Chase. The end. That's all a receiver needs to hear. You tell a receiver, well, here's my resume. Two NFL draft picks back-to-back years, and oh, by the way, they're two of the five best receivers in the NFL. What else do you need? Do I need to tell you anything else about me? That's all you need. Kind of like if if somebody was going out and trying to recruit writers, and they say, here's our four APSI awards or whatever. I don't, believe me, that isn't remotely compared to Jamar Chase and Justin Jefferson, right? It doesn't. But the point being, you want to know what you're coming to play for? Those two names. Here are their cell phone numbers. Call them. Ask them what they think of me. Sold. You know? And that's what I think Joseph can bring to the table, is a guy that can walk into a room and go get a kid like that.
Last thing on this front. You, Sam McEwen, are Scott Frost for a day, and that day happens to be the day where it is time to pick an offensive coordinator. Right. Who would you pick?
I don't know that there'd be a name. I've tried to think about this process through, qualities and traits and frameworks. I think you want to go find somebody who can fit with who Scott Frost is, somebody who has a pretty, I don't know if romantic's the right word, but somebody who has a healthy, abiding appreciation for the run game. And I don't know that that was true of Troy Walters, and I don't think it was true of Matt Lubick. I mean, I got along really well with Mike Riley, but I don't think it was true of Mike Riley. We had Steven Jackson, it was. But Mike liked throwing the ball. So did Danny Langsdorf. So did Bill Callahan. Deep down, now Bill Callahan's an offensive line coach for the Browns, and boy, he does a hell of a job with them. But, deep down, these guys like throwing the ball around. They were former quarterbacks, or they played in that kind of operation, and they're like every former quarterback. They dream of throwing the ball 45 times and matriculating it down the field like they're Joe Montana. So I think it would be good to have a coordinator who has a deep, abiding love for the offensive line and for a run game, and understands what a good run game and a good offensive line can do for an offense, and more importantly, do for a quarterback. I wouldn't mind seeing a system that de-emphasized quarterback play and re-emphasized all of the pieces within the hash marks around the quarterback. Not necessarily the wide receivers, but the line, the running backs, and the tight end. I felt like for one game, for one half this year, Nebraska tried doing that against Illinois. It didn't go very well, and they went back to the Wild West in that second half. And deep down, they've just kind of been that since. Like they, we'll run it. If we run the ball, great. If we don't, we'll throw the ball. Like, we're not going to keep running it, okay? We're not going to beat our heads against the wall here. We're just going to throw the ball, because that's how we get our 27-yard gains. You saw it against Iowa. Well, we're not gonna, I want my 28-yard gain. So you ain't getting a run of the ball. The only way you're getting a run of the ball is running an option or play-action pass, throwing it over the top. And Nebraska, and I'm not trying to be stupid here by saying Nebraska's a little addicted to big chunk gains. Of course you are, because that's part of how you score in football. So you need to be addicted to them to some degree. But I think there does come a point where there's a feeling like, well, you know, what we really need to do here is get a bunch of yards early, and then there's a cumulative power to running the football over the course of four quarters that can actually be interrupted by a bunch of big chunk plays, you know? And football's not boxing. You cannot knock out your opponent with one touchdown. You can't.
Well, Iowa did.
No, but I mean, you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying.
Like, you can hit an 85-yard pass for a touchdown, and that might make everybody on the other team red-faced, but it's still only worth 7 points. It's not worth any more points. Whereas in a boxing match, if you hit somebody with an uppercut, a wild uppercut just so, they're out. And that's worth more than 100 body blows. In football, the 100 body blows might end up being the more important thing to do. And so I'd love to see Nebraska find somebody who has an almost romantic love for the run game.
We know you do, Sam. No one appreciates what? Oh yeah, we know you appreciate it.
Wisconsin has that.
Oh, I mean it's the identity of the Big Ten West. It's the identity of their entire division. So I totally understand.
I mean, for half of the season, Illinois was running a quarterback out there that was, you know, nowhere near as good as Adrian Martinez. We'll just leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about Sitkowski.
I'm not aware.
Their offense functioned just fine. They didn't gain that many yards at times, and a couple times they got shut down or shut out. But they beat Minnesota, and they beat Penn State, and Nebraska didn't do either one of those things. And they did it because they ran the damn ball. And you impose your will on an opponent that way. We'll see.
They have those hats for a reason on the offensive line.
They do.
Damn, there was somebody at an NFL game. They should have fan wearing a run the damn ball hat.
I believe it.
This weekend. All right. Should we go to hoops?
Yeah. Nebraska basketball is 5-2. They now play how many power six teams in a row?
Five.
Five in a row?
They've won four in a row. First time under Fred Hoiberg.
Let's rattle off the five teams they're about to play.
NC State on Wednesday, Indiana Saturday, Michigan next Tuesday, Auburn on December 11th in Atlanta, 11 a.m. start, ESPN, big spot, Kansas State, December 19th after finals week.
Okay. What is true, generally speaking, of Power 6 teams, and by Power 6 we include all the Power 5s plus the Big East, that is not true of the teams that Nebraska has played up to this point other than Creighton.
What is true?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you what is true of what happens to Nebraska when they venture outside of their warm, cozy home arena where they're hosting all these mid-major opponents.
Mm-hmm.
I did a breakdown. This is Big Ten versus non-conference, but it's, you know, their non-conference slate has not included too many.
No, it hasn't. That's right.
Power six opponents.
That's right. Agreed.
I did a quick numbers dive on this last night.
Okay.
What is true of Nebraska's offense against non-conference teams? They shoot well from inside the three-point line. Last year, they shot 53% from two in non-conference. And then in conference play, they shot 41% inside the three-point line. They generated, where are the free throw numbers? 24 free throw attempts per game. Non-conference is very good. It's right on par with where they're at right now. In conference play, they generated 16 mm-hmm. free throw attempts per game.
Mm-hmm.
So what is true about all of these Power 6 teams, sorry, Big East, that is not true of all these Western Illinois, even though they won, or South Dakotas. There's more size. Even though NC State, for example, the guy who plays the four for most of their rotations, 6'7". you gotta see him. He's not small. He's long and lengthy and quite the athlete. That these are the players that South Dakota's never gonna get.
Mm-hmm.
That's who Nebraska is about to run into. NC State is a middling ACC team, but they are, other than Creighton, easily the biggest test that Nebraska will face this year because of their athleticism.
I guarantee they have better athletes.
Relentlessness.
And I'm not trying to knock
for
Creighton.
For sure, for sure.
They have better athletes than Creighton.
They're relentless. I mean, they press for 40 minutes. They are super duper long, and they attack the rim and they protect the rim. Mm-hmm. They're going to bother Nebraska when Nebraska has the ball, when Nebraska's away from the ball. That stuff we were talking about after the Creighton game where Hoiberg was saying Creighton got physical with Bryce McGowan's and he needed to do more stuff off the ball. Mm-hmm. Let's see how it works this week, because he's going to run into a lot of the same stuff. Trace Jackson Davis in Indiana, I was watching some highlights of him against Marshall. Granted, it's Marshall, not necessarily a program known for its defense. Just eating him alive. He is a man-child.
He's a skilled player.
But he's so powerful. He's very skilled. Yeah. But he's so powerful. Mm-hmm. And he's not that much bigger than Derek Walker. But he just plays like he's much bigger than Derek Walker. People bounce off of him. He dunks over people. He's a monster down low. And Derek Walker has been efficient down low against a lot of these mid-major teams. What's it going to look like when he has to bang bodies with a dude that's chiseled from rock? That's what we're here to find out this week.
That's a hell of a good point. Boy, that's a really good point. People should rewind what Jimmy just said and listen to the last 2 minutes. Here's why. Nebraska has made, and believe me, this is good. I appreciate Fred Hoiberg's scheduling strategy. I think it paid off.
Oh, yeah, they needed to build confidence with this group.
Correct.
They had to.
But, you know, Bryce McGowan's has had an incredible start. But I don't know what percentage of his points are off free throws. But that percentage is about to go down. Because he's not just going to be able to get to the rim at will against North Carolina State and Indiana. He's going to have to work. You know, he's probably going to have to hit some jumpers in order to get those sort of free passes to the rim. And so that's a good example of, you know, you don't want to be so on the nose and pedantic that, like, you watch tomorrow night's game and you think, well, I mean, why isn't Bryce going to the rim? Because he can't. Because the players they're playing are better.
And bigger.
And bigger and
stronger.
Longer.
And
right.
And he's very, don't get me wrong, this dude is super skilled. There was a play against South Dakota on Saturday where Bryce spins out. He had the ball on the right wing coming towards the press row, mm-hmm. and he spins away from a defender. There's another dude standing right where he spins, and he just tapped his foot in whatever spatial awareness he has that none of the rest of us have, he used it. He tapped his foot exactly where he needed to Eurostep around that guy and draw a foul. Mm-hmm. He's super skilled, but he might not get around that first guy this week.
That's right. I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is, and this is just in my experience what I've found, is in watching Nebraska basketball and also covering it last year, is a lot of Power 6 teams, even though you would think that everybody sort of mirrors that pace and space that you see in the NBA, a lot of them don't. A lot of them don't mirror that at all. In fact, they love mid-range shots, and they love going into the paint, and they don't mind playing that way. It may not be the way to the NBA, but of course, the NBA isn't the point of Nebraska basketball. Going to the NCAA tournament, winning there is the point of Nebraska basketball. And so, for example, Georgia Tech had a team that came in here last year, and Georgia Tech was in the NCAA tournament, lost, I think, to Loyola. I can't remember who they lost to. Somebody good that went a long way in the NCAA tournament. Georgia Tech had a guy that was basically didn't shoot three-pointers. James Wright, I think was his name. And they had a couple of good guards, a couple that hit some threes. But really what they did is they got to the rim. And they were quick and they were tough. And Wright made some shots. And I think that was his name. And Nebraska lost the game. Nebraska actually played pretty well. Kobe had 20, hit some threes. I think Nebraska would tell you they played pretty well that day against one of the best teams they played all season. But they fell short, especially in the second half, because that team just kept coming at them and coming at them and coming at them. And I've seen enough games both in the men's and the women's side to know that the ACC, the caliber of athlete in the ACC, and they're often pretty skilled, is better than what they're putting out in the Big Ten. It's better. Like, the Big Ten might be tougher, but the caliber of athlete in the ACC is just better. They're faster, they run, you know, they're longer, all those things. And so Nebraska's got they got their hands full. A lot of times they've played maybe the second or the third worst team in the ACC when they do this challenge thing. I feel like NC State is a cut above that, right?
Pretty good.
They're maybe like
so far. I mean, they lost
like eighth or ninth.
They lost key guard, but they've looked pretty good. They have.
I was kind of surprised Nebraska got this draw, but they've played so many of the dregs that I feel like it was almost time. for them to face somebody that was a little bit tough. And last year they did. I mean, Georgia Tech was, you know, we got there and we're like, oh God, this team's good. You know, this Nebraska's playing somebody's a little out of their league. It feels like, again, they kind of drew that game too. So they start the Big Ten on Friday, or Saturday, against Indiana. What do we know about the Big Ten compared to last year? It doesn't seem like it's quite the same league as it was last year, but, you know, it's the Big Ten.
I would say there's not as much of a crowd at the top. Purdue is clear-cut above the rest early in the season. I think Michigan has the potential to get up to Purdue's level. They had a ton of talent. They are, you know, the numbers still love Michigan, even though they've lost two games to Marquette and Cincinnati that they probably shouldn't have lost.
Right.
But the level right below that, I'm working on Big Ten rankings for Friday. I have Purdue in its own tier. Michigan's in its own tier right now, for now. We'll see how the rest of the week plays out because there's some big games coming up. And then there's this huge jumble of a third tier with Illinois, who seems to be really missing Io DeSunmu more than I think we all thought they would. They are an egregious turnover team.
Yeah, they play pretty breakneck.
Yeah. Ohio State has the talent, but is still gelling around with some new faces.
Yeah.
Iowa, frankly, a lot better. Iowa beat Virginia last night on buzzer beater. They are undefeated. They look much better than I thought.
He can coach.
Yes, he very much can. He really can.
Let's be honest.
Yeah.
He can coach.
Great coach. Wisconsin looks better. The defense has carried over from since Greg Gard has gotten there. They've had some ups and downs. Pretty much every year, that defense has been excellent.
Right.
And it is carrying them through. They have a huge win over Houston. Granted, Houston plays the exact kind of style that Wisconsin likes to play. So that helps. But they're in that jumbled pack too. Michigan State's in that jumbled pack too. Indiana's in that jumbled pack. They haven't played anybody yet, but they're undefeated. They look pretty good. There's all of those teams that are jumbled up. It's not at the top anymore. It's not as, you know, Nebraska has no chance tonight against a lot of these teams last year, right? They're not going to beat. They're not going to beat a lot of those teams, right?
Sure.
For a variety of reasons. Now, they can beat. Probably beat some of these teams on any given night. I don't think Nebraska totally could go into Indiana and win on Saturday, but they have to play their best to win it, and it's that way the entire way. I mean, Northwestern's off to a good start. You looked at the schedule before the year, you're like, well, at least they got two games against Northwestern. I don't know that you feel that way anymore. Nebraska's balance, their chemistry, the way they work together on the court is very delicate.
Mm-hmm.
It's Alonzo Verge. I don't want to pile on Alonzo Verge. I think he's been put in a tough spot. They grabbed him late, put him in a role that he has not been used to playing. But he's the guy that they are saying, here, man, you're running the show. And he's getting yanked at the first sign of, mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't play for the final, I think it was 12 minutes again on Saturday against South Dakota because he took a turnaround jumper. And I get that Fred has to show him, hey, that's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
But he has no room for mistakes, it feels like, at this point. Fred clearly feels that everything needs to be working in concert. Mm-hmm. And Alonzo Verge was the key to everything working in concert. He was the guy who was going to get everyone else started. They have a team built. They built a team of finishers with very few creators, and the guy who they thought was going to be the primary creator, it's not working out. And if that continues, if we continue down that path, I think he has done it once already in a couple of games where they had 18 assists. He's brought it back to where he needed to be. I think he can do it again. But if we continue down this rocky path where sometimes they move the ball great, sometimes they don't, sometimes they play good transition defense, sometimes they don't, it's going to be a problem because mm-hmm. there's a baseline. What I'm trying to say is there's a baseline level of competence still in the Big Ten that Nebraska has not yet hit under Hoiberg. There are a variety of reasons for that. He has called it the biggest rebuild in college basketball history or something. I don't have the bandwidth to understand what that is compared to, but I do understand that it was a big rebuild job.
Yeah, I think Scott Drew probably had the biggest, but Hoiberg at Nebraska.
It was a big deal, but there's still a baseline level in the Big Ten that Nebraska has to prove it can meet
before
we can start putting it into the conversations that it was being put into at the beginning of the season. Rightfully so, they have a lot of talent on this team, but they still have to prove that they can get there.
Every sport's a little bit of a combination of art and math. You know, one of the things that I think we all love about sports is there's a certain embedded beauty to it, but there's also a certain bottom line logic to winning and losing, right? And in the last 15, 20, 25 years, the math portion has grown in its share of prominence, while the art portion, the sports writer portion, has shrunk, right? So, like, it's not really about how beautiful your swing is anymore in baseball, but what you do with the swing and, you know.
It's not just that we can calculate how correct your swing is.
Like the exit velocity and all this other stuff. And, you know, people used to have a sort of romanticism about, you know, a submarine baller, but, you know, I mean, who gives a shit if he can't throw strikes? Fred Hoiberg, his system is a blend of both, obviously, because when it's working the way it's supposed to be working, it looks pretty. But it's math. And so on some level, what he needs, a guy like Alonzo Verge, who is a very expressionistic player, with all the little moves and all the things
he's art. That's
right.
What
I appreciate that actually about him. Like, he's got the fakes and the head fakes and the little fallaways and the pretty stuff.
Crossovers.
But what he has to understand, I think, where Hoiberg, and this is more on, to me, this is more on the adult millionaire than it is on Verge. You have to get players to understand why you want them to commit to your system of math. And it's that, Alonzo, if you keep throwing the ball out to these guys, eventually they will have had so many reps at doing what they're doing that the ball will start to go in. And once it goes in, all the artistic stuff you want to do, you'll be able to do because they'll be worried about the shooters. The problem is at the moment, and it's an understandable frustration that Verge probably has, is I think any player who watches what Nebraska does probably has in their mind, well, these dudes aren't making any shots tonight, so somebody's going to have to go score! Right? The same thing with Bryce. Like, Bryce gets the ball and I'm going to have to go score! Nobody else is going to score!
Bryce has been...
know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying. Bryce has been much better as a passer these last few games.
But the point is that there's a connective tissue to what he's trying to get done, and gol darn it, you recruit the guys to make the shots, they gotta make the shots, or otherwise the distributors and the playmakers are like, what the hell am I doing? I'm keep throwing to these guys, and they don't make the shots. So in some ways, you know, Casey and Latt are huge. They have to make shots, or otherwise the system doesn't work. And I think there's a sense of eventually they're going to make the shots. You have to let the system work for about 12 games. And then all of a sudden, about 12, 13 games in, and you got to understand, and you know this, the first team that Hoiberg put together was a mess. It wasn't his fault. They had no chemistry, and they had a guy that was shooting 23%, jacking up 13 threes a game, and he wasn't any good. Last year was a mess because of COVID. So this is the first chance they've really had to make the thing work. They need to try to make it work for about 12 or 13 games. And eventually, I think the theory is, when we get to January, the shit's going to kick in. And when it kicks in, then all of a sudden it looks like it did at the end of last year, and you're beating Rutgers by 20, and you're taking other teams to the wire, and you have these stretches of basketball where you look like you could beat anybody. But you don't get to that until you work the system. And like, so for me, when I watch it, I'm like, Latman, Casey, CJ, they're huge. People keep talking about Verge, and I get it, or Bryce, but man, they got to hit the threes. If they're open, make the threes. You play, you shoot to make the three.
And
that's why they're there.
And for the people who are saying, who might be thinking, you know, it's late November, early December. We don't need to be making snap judgments about this team right now. I understand that impulse, but to your point,
think fair, yeah.
I think so too. But to your point, Sam, this team needs to see it pay off.
Sure.
For that January, it click, that you're talking about to happen, they need to see some sign of it early. And, you know, for Nebraska's sake, thank God for Casey on Saturday.
Right.
It's the way he was getting, because Casey could have hit five threes shooting, you know, pull up transition threes or hitting some step backs, and they wouldn't have learned
or
anything
jokey,
from that.
You know,
yes.
Goof luck
shots. They might not have learned anything from that. He hit shots running around screens, right, and guys looking for him and hit the screen. That's important.
Yep.
That's important. Not only that he made those threes, but the way that they generated mm-hmm. those looks for him. That's very important. It's important that CJ Wiltshire has been off to a good start shooting. He's the only, you could say, consistent shooter on the team right now. That's very important that he's been able to get looks, and he's pretty much the way he has to get looks is within the framework of the system. It will be important that Lat Man, who in his defense was dealing with injuries during the preseason, it's important that he gets back to Lat Man shooting, I think, 34-35% from three last year.
And
that's
he got
very
better
important.
At the end of last year.
All that stuff matters.
And Keon Edwards has to. I mean, these guys have to hit shots.
All that stuff matters right now.
Yeah,
because it matters right now, because if they continue, it can only be considered a slump for so long, right? Otherwise, you lose trust, especially with a team that was. They have more returners than they ever had before. Mm-hmm. They were excited about their continuity at the beginning of the season. Still a lot of new faces, man.
Sure.
Still a lot of new faces. 8 new scholarship players. A lot of those dudes playing significant roles. By the way, 2 of them, the guys who have the ball in their hands most of the time.
Right.
Lonzo Verge, Bryce McGowan's.
Right. That's a good point.
Matters right now that those guys are in the trust of the people who are not making shots. Those guys need to start making shots.
In theory, they could lose, for example, 76-59 tomorrow night, or 83-64 to Indiana. And I covered Fred last year. He's the kind of guy that will go, yeah, I mean, I like the looks that we got. We just have to make the shots, and we will. And
over results. That's sensible, but that's not how your 22-year-old point guard thinks. That's not how everyone thinks all the time.
Well, it's finite too.
Yeah.
And then this is the part where I think Hoiberg has to, you know, also, and I think he does. It's not 82 games. Whereas, of course, the 82-game season, there's a lot of things that can happen that can go right. You can win, 14 out of 20 somewhere in there. But that's the piece, is that, like, you can have a night where you lose 76-59, and the reason you lost is we didn't make the shots that we designed to make, and the guys that were supposed to make them didn't make them, so I don't feel that bad about how we played. That's how Brad Stevens coached for the Celtics for years. They didn't win anything. We got to be honest about that, too. Brad Stevens eventually had to walk away from being a head coach and become a GM because the message wasn't getting through. Like, the hay's in the barn, but it doesn't matter because there wasn't enough hay. And, you can get lost in that world. And where Nebraska, and I think to some degree that I can understand a player like Verge coming into a system and going, my job is to facilitate shots, and they're not making the shots, so I need to make the shots. The other thing is Verge had many games in a row where he didn't even try to get them shots. He just went right to the rim right away.
He's gotten better.
And so, I think that's the thing that's hard at times. Nebraska fans have to be really patient there, because the system that they're running is a system. And just like in basketball, you got to wait to make those shots. What I've wanted for Nebraska football to get to is a system where you run the ball over and over until it works. And by the fourth quarter, it does. And at the end of the season, when you have to run the ball, you can. And repeatedly, in Frost's tenure, they get to the end of the season, and they might be able to run the ball, and they might not. They have to have the right opponent whose butt they can kick, like Rutgers. And I would love to see a team that just says, we're going to run the ball, and our mindset of running the ball, part of the reason we're going to run the ball, is to run the ball. It's not to gain yards. It's not necessarily to score touchdowns, but to impose our physical will that we believe will pay off in the fourth quarter. We're not worried about a 3-yard carry here because it's going to become a larger carry there. Eric Chenander said it when they faced Wisconsin. Wisconsin's comfortable with these 4-yard carries because they know they're going to become 8-yard carries, and then they're going to hit a big one, which is exactly what happened. Like, the defensive coordinator is able to explain to a T what the other team is going to do. He knows they're going to do it. Wisconsin knows they're going to do it. And then they do it. And Minnesota, which beat Wisconsin last weekend, pretty impressive. is a team that is built so similarly to Wisconsin that they can stop it because that's all they do too. And Nebraska has to decide on some level in football. Do we want to be the outlier, or do we want to be like everybody else and learn how to do it the way they do it and then maybe beat them because we know how to do it? Or do we want to be the outlier who's unlike these other teams and might take them off guard at times, but ultimately lose the friggin' games? Because they're 6-17 against the West. So you can either be Purdue or you can be Minnesota. Purdue and Minnesota are both doing a better job of being who they are than Nebraska is, in part because Purdue finally found a quarterback and they have the receivers, and Minnesota decided to, you know, run behind a bunch of 400-pounders. In basketball, if Fred wants to get this system, they got to hit the shots. Creighton has shot makers and shot takers. Nebraska's got to get shot takers. And so K-State's game on Saturday was probably one of the most encouraging things because finally somebody made shots.
To your point about Wisconsin 4-yard runs becoming 8-yard runs, there's a purpose to slamming your face into right. a defensive line. The same thing, in a way, is sort of true about these three-point shots. The idea is not that you're just going to shoot teams under a barrel of three-point jump shots. That's not the idea. The idea is that the defense will become so concerned about your shooters
right.
that they can't help off the shooters, and then your Alonzo Verges and your Bryce McGowans have a free path to the rim. They just have to beat one guy,
right.
which they are very capable of doing.
Right.
So it's the same idea, but the same concept applies. You got to do it. You got to make the shot.
And
you have to prove you can do it.
Hoiberg's system's understandable. Yeah. Like, you go into the lane. You have a jump stop. You pass it out. That guy has a shot or he doesn't. If he doesn't, he fakes it. He dribbles. He passes. The next guy looks. Does he have a shot? No. He passes. He passes. He passes.
It's very, there's a fake. If then.
Yeah. It's not like it's rocket science. You just have to be disciplined. And I'll be curious to see if Nebraska is disciplined. Likewise, Doc Sadler's defense. You know what Doc Sadler's defense is going to do. If you execute it well, okay, a team that hits a bunch of threes might beat you. Tennessee State hit a crap load and they didn't beat them.
Yeah.
Western Illinois beat them, though, because they got the offensive boards and they got to the rim. Like, Doc Sadler is a very good coach. He may be flawed as a recruiter when he was at Nebraska, but he knows what he's doing. And if you take the paint away and you force a team to hit bombs all night long, a team like Tennessee State is not going to hit 22 of them. They might hit 12, they might hit 15, but they're going to fall short. Doc gets it. And people are critical of Doc. They watch that game against Tennessee State and they're like, and I get it. They hit a bunch of threes, but eventually they stopped. You play the numbers.
Well, and they were also in that game the idea is not just let them shoot threes as they did against Tennessee State. The idea is still to get out there or know where the shooter is going to be. And too often when you rewatch these games, it's like the lasting through seven games, my lasting image of Nebraska's defense is, doesn't matter who it is, Nebraska jersey pointing, saying, "We need to switch here."
Mm-hmm.
And either they weren't supposed to switch or the other guy didn't see that they were supposed to switch. They both go in one direction, and there's a shooter there. He's open. That's happened too often.
Mm-hmm.
And these, oftentimes it has resulted in against South Dakota especially. That happened a couple times against South Dakota's best shooter.
Mm-hmm.
I think his last name is Perot Hunt. And he filled it up against him. There are going to be more of those guys in the Big Ten too, to bring it back to where we were in the beginning of this. There are more talented players, more shooters, better shooters, bigger shooters.
The thing that kills them are good posts.
Yeah, well, yeah.
They have to find, you know, within the recruiting process, Blaise Keita.
That's who they think he's going to be.
They think
he's the most Big Ten ready big. Already in the Big Ten right now.
We have to be honest. They thought they were going to get Adama Sanogo. What are his numbers at UConn? What are they? Look them up.
They're quite. We were talking about this last week.
They're unbelievable.
Yeah,
this is the guy
like
that could have been at
never. A game or something like that.
He's the best center in the Big East.
Yeah,
he's one of the five best centers in college basketball. They almost got him. Now what they got instead is Duardo Andre, and again, This is, I think, a deal where they have been very, what do you want to call what they've been with Eduardo Andre? They've been very expectant. They've tried to, you know, disciplinary. They don't want to play him too much.
They've been trying to give him the kick.
But man, sometimes you just got to put the guy out there and let him get slammed a few times.
Yep.
And then he'll either find his pride or he won't.
Yeah, he's going to be more important, much more important in Big Ten play. And I thought it was interesting that Fred shrugged off. I asked a question about Wilhelm Breidenbach, who's averaging, I think, 8.3 fouls per 40 minutes right now. And Fred said it's an effort thing, and he's not out of position. That's all great, but the tendency to foul, like that aggression that Fred is talking about, is a good thing on a certain level. But when you're playing someone a lot bigger than you, that's not that those fouls are going to keep happening.
Yeah,
gets switched onto I think he'll play more four in Big Ten play because they don't want him guarding those super big dudes. He's not ready for that yet.
Right.
But it's gonna happen.
Yeah,
bodies get mixed up down there, so that's something that needs to be watched for as well. And when because they don't have that big body who can match up with Hunter Dickinson's, Trey Jackson Davis's.
There's a certain amount of genius to the way that you do your non-conference scheduling, the way you figure it out, because what you want to face in a non-conference schedule is a variety of teams and a variety of different kinds of players. And there are some teams that don't get scheduled very often. They play in the MAC. That are like, no, we're not playing you. We don't want to play a 62-53 game. You might beat us. You're not going to play ball with us. We're going to bring you in here, Toledo, and you're going to beat us. Forget it. You go play, you know, over here, go play a bunch of other mid-majors. There are leagues that don't get the benefit of that because they're pains in the ass to play and they slow it down. And, you know, like Tennessee State didn't win, but they're super beneficial for Nebraska because they hit a bunch of shots. And that's like, here, you see? You got to learn. We won, but you learned a lesson. Teams like that are great to play. Like, the teams you don't want to play are the ones that, you know, want to drag the game to a 50-point game and aren't teaching you anything because you're not going to play anybody in the Big Ten that does that, which is why MAC teams, you know, one of your alma maters, it's one of the reasons they don't play. They don't have great, what do you call it, RPIs.
Yeah.
Because they always get stuck playing hard games. Nebraska did a nice job, I thought, of scheduling a variety of teams that gave them various looks.
For certain, by purpose. And I wouldn't want to play my Ohio Bobcats right now either. They are ranked one spot ahead of Nebraska, actually.
All of those teams. If you look at all those teams in the MAC, they're always like that. And so, like, somebody told me this years ago, I think it was a women's basketball coach, of like, you don't want to play teams that aren't going to do you any good when you get into league play. And that was like, the teams that play super slow down basketball, they can go play that in their league. We don't. But conversely, when they get to the NCAA tournament,
it works.
The last team you want to play is Stephen F. Austin.
Loyola.
You don't want to play these teams.
Yeah.
Because you get there and then all of a sudden, and Hoiberg played one when they lost to UAB or whatever. Like, you don't want to play these teams that slow it down, and you don't play them all year, then you get in the NCAA. Anyway, getting off the point. Anything else about hoops?
I would say this. Two wins would be huge success in this stretch, I think. Because they are, I think, currently, by percentages, supposed to lose all five of them. I think Kansas State, or maybe this has changed in recent weeks. Yeah, they're now 155% likely to beat Kansas State, I guess. But two wins would be fantastic. Even, honestly, one, not to bring the close loss narrative back into Nebraska mind fans focus, but even one win and four close losses, I think would be progress here.
You have five games. You want them to go 2-3. The two most likely to win are
Kansas State and tomorrow night, I think.
Okay.
Maybe Indiana, but Indiana's tough on the road.
Okay. You don't think PBA is going to show out for Michigan?
I'm sure they will. Michigan's just really good.
They are.
Michigan is unique in that they can be big and small at the same time. Mm-hmm. Their big guys can move like small guys, and they just have a ton of bodies, and they're really good. And I don't know, they've started slower than I anticipated, but I believe that in the potential of that team, they are quite good, and I think they're gonna put it. I mean, they're gonna put it together pretty quick here.
Hmm. We'll see. I think the game that they're least likely to win is Auburn.
I would agree.
Personally,
I would agree.
Because again, those teams in the SEC and the ACC, Wouldn't say that they're as skilled as the Big Ten teams or as tough, but the athleticism is really high. I'd say that's the least likely to win. I don't like their chances tomorrow night, and it's no knock on Nebraska. I think it's hard to play in the middle of the week, on the road, at night, in a city you've never been in. Actually, Nebraska has historically played pretty well at Indiana. Tim Miles won there twice. Fred took Indiana to OT in his first year. I kind of like their chances there, and I like them to beat K-State.
Yeah,
I'd say their two best chances to win are at Indiana and K-State. I think you can catch Indiana early on a sleepy Saturday morning. Their crowd will not be awake. They won't be expecting a good game. I think Nebraska can go in there and hit some shots. Again, Tim Miles won there twice and like five tries. So that's a team Nebraska's had success against since joining the Big Ten. Doc beat them. Tim beat them twice. Maybe, might have beat them three times. I think Tim actually beat them three times. He might have beat them once at home. You'll see this when you go in. Indiana's not a big team. At least they weren't under Archie Miller. They're kind of skilled, but they're small, and they don't jump off the screen at you except for Trace Jackson. He does,
so good.
But their guards are smaller than Nebraska's guards. They're like, I wasn't blown away by them. When Michigan came in, I was like, Cadillac. When Indiana came in, I was like, they're okay.
They built their schedule the same exact way. They've not been tested yet. We'll see. They play Syracuse tonight.
That'll be a good game. Quick minute on the women. They're 7-0. They play Wake Forest tomorrow night. This is probably the best Nebraska team that Amy Williams has had since her NCAA tournament team, and it might be her best team overall. The challenge that they have tomorrow night is they're playing an athletic team. Wake Forest is athletic. A lot of those teams on the East Coast tend to be. They're not as skilled as Maryland, which is the most athletic team in the Big Ten, and they're probably more skilled but less athletic than Rutgers, which is the other team that is the most athletic team in the Big Ten. I would say that Nebraska could win. If they win, that's a big deal, and then they play at Minnesota, and if they win that and they start 9-0, they'll be ranked. And if they do that, it could be a fun year. Big Ten, the women's side, the Big Ten on the women's side is stronger than the men's side a little bit. At the top, you have four teams that are in the top 12. Maryland is six, Indiana eight, Iowa nine. Iowa had COVID, so they missed a bunch of games. Michigan, I think, is 12. Of those four teams, I think Maryland is the best, but we'll see. And Nebraska might be the fifth or sixth best team in the league, and they have a player on their team. They have a player on their team that's pretty darn good.
All right, that'll do it for this week's Pick 6 podcast from Sam, Evan, in spirit. We will talk to you next week. Enjoy your championship Saturday.